This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National with me, Keri Phillips. If we needed a reminder of the violent power of water, the tsunami of 2004, which killed about 300,000 people, and Hurricane Katrina, which destroyed the city of New Orleans last year, surely provided it.
80% of New Orleans is underwater, in some areas up to 6 meters deep, and more water is pouring through breaches and levees around the city.
So much water just being flung. All these buildings are like falling on top of you and crashing around you. You're totally underwater. You're like, you can't breathe. You know, you're drinking loads of water. You're drowning.
Today, to mark the second anniversary of the tsunami, we'll hear again a program about some of the cities that have succumbed to a watery grave and about human attempts to hold back the tide. As we'll hear later, the contemporary threat of water to city life is framed in terms of climate change and rising sea levels. But for almost as long as we've been living in cities, the danger has been in what lies below the oceans. Dr. Mark Horton is Head of Archaeology and Anthropology at Bristol University.
Cities rarely only start about 5,000 years ago. And that's the period when essentially global sea level rises had actually very much slowed down. So the sorts of sites that we tend to find underwater are those that have gone undersea because of earthquakes or tsunamis or catastrophic events rather than just the general rise in sea level over the centuries. I mean, they're scattered all around the world. I mean, there are examples in the Caribbean, there are examples in the Mediterranean, in particular, because, of course, Eastern Mediterranean is subject to a huge sort of tectonic activity. And I suppose the most famous, as it were, submerged city, or part of a submerged city, is Alexandria on the mouth of the Nile in Egypt, where recently, really since the 1990s, maritime archaeology has exposed the sort of the palaces of Cleopatra, the harbour installations, temples, and just amazing stuff.
Do we know why it went underwater?
Well, largely because of tectonic activity. Essentially, the part of the harbour just literally moved down into the sea. The sea level in that part of the Mediterranean has actually not changed that much over the centuries, maybe half a metre or something like that. And a lot of this stuff is 4 or 5 metres below sea level. So almost certainly it was a result of earthquake activity, although I think still the details of when this happened and how it happened remain somewhat obscure. Essentially, it seems that it was really going on in the sort of 3rd century AD or thereabouts. The underwater archaeology hasn't really produced much material much later than that. But it's probably a series of events rather than just one catastrophic event. It all became fairly untenable. And as far as we know, as it were, no loss of life were involved, but simply people just abandoned the area to the sea as the site gradually subsided by these fairly minor earthquakes beneath the water. I mean, it's very different to a much more spectacular site, that's a Port Royal in Jamaica, which went underwater. We actually know exactly when. It was 11:43 in the morning on June the 7th, 1692. We know that because the archaeologists have excavated a pocket watch and the hands are actually at that very moment. Port Royal was the most important commercial city, port city, certainly in the English Caribbean in the 17th century. It was notorious, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean was seen there, you know, Henry Morgan. It was a rough place, but it was also an incredibly lucrative place in which people were making their fortunes from the expanding world of all those different industries, slave trade and so forth that was going on in the region. rather decadent. And that was an earthquake, and half the city literally just went down vertically beneath the waves, and some 2,000 people lost their lives, and something like 3,000 people died subsequently of injuries and so forth as a result. And much of that city is still there, literally below the waves. And there's been a project there since the 1980s, which you can dive along, you can walk along the streets, as it were, and you can see the remains of the houses and the floors and the gardens and so forth are there. The city is almost laid out as it was at that moment.
So are there any actual towns or cities that have slipped beneath the sea due to rising sea levels?
Well, I'm deeply sceptical of this, and essentially one can point to buried prehistoric landscapes all around the world that are a result of sea level changes. I mean, for example, let's go back into deep prehistory. At the end of the Ice Age, essentially at around 18,000 years ago, sea levels were about 100 metres lower than they are today, and the vast bulk of that sea level rise has taken place up to around 4,000 BC, about 6,000 years ago. And, for example, Britain was connected to the Netherlands at that time. And, you know, we've got what archaeologists call Doggerland. It's now Dogger Bank. It's a fishing area, but constantly trawlers and things are picking up bits of bone and flint artifacts and so forth. This was, you know, plains that people would hunt and live and so forth. Another really spectacular example is the Isles of Scilly, which is a small archipelago off the coast of Cornwall in England, where you can literally see the field boundaries of the Neolithic farms going beneath the sea as the sea level has come up and just covered this prehistoric landscape and is now almost wholly under the sea.
Perhaps the best-known contemporary example of a city under threat of drowning is Venice, whose problems are man-made. Professor Jörg Imberger is director of the Centre for Water Research at the University of Western Australia.
An estuary or a lagoon like the Venice Lagoon is in equilibrium historically between the river inflow, which brings not just fresh water but also brings silt and sand, and then the mouth, which sort of faces to the ocean, where the silt and sand is lost. So if an estuary stays in equilibrium for a long time, then that means that the amount of silt that you bring in via the rivers is roughly balanced, at least on a long time scale, with what you lose through the mouth. And about 200 or 300 years ago, because of flooding, they started to reroute some of the rivers to get the river to flow directly into the Adriatic. That was the first thing that happened. So they cut off the source of sediments, which kept the estuary in equilibrium. The second thing that happened in just after the war, there's a town called Mestre. It's sort of next to Padua. Mestre is right on the shoreline of the Venice Lagoon. They started to pump groundwater because they needed a source of water, and so there was groundwater, so they pumped it. And that led to a general sinking of the island of Venice and all the islands in the Venice Lagoon. So as the land began to subside, and at the same time you're cutting out the source of sediment, everything sort of turned a little worse. Then the next thing that happened is agriculture very much increased, and so you had the nutrients coming in, and they were feeding or basically causing a switch from seagrasses to algal blooms. So the seagrasses couldn't sustain themselves for two reasons. One is that the water was getting deeper and they were getting out of the light zone. And the second thing is that the algae, which is sort of a plant, I mean, it's very small plants, I mean, very small particles, was making the water more turbid so the light couldn't get down to the seagrasses. So the seagrasses started to die. And of course, the seagrasses are rooted, so they were holding the sediment together. So there comes the next factor, and that is that as the seagrasses died, the whole bottom of the Venice Lagoon started to become mobile. And as it became mobile, it sort of went straight out the three mouths, Kioja, Malamoko, and I've forgotten the name of the third one. So the sediment was going out at an even faster rate. So the city was actually, or is, sinking because of a number of reasons. And now, most recently, of course, as everybody knows, climate change is kicking in, so the sea level is rising.
Professor Imberger says that the proposed plan to save Venice may come at the cost of the region's $6 million fishing industry and still not provide a satisfactory outcome for the city.
there's a plan, a concrete plan, to put in gates. In other words, you close off the three mouths and you allow a differential to develop between the Adriatic and the Venice Lagoon, and you shelter the city of Venice, which is an island in the middle of this lagoon, from these high water levels. But of course, if you just think about some of the statistics, the number of days where you had flood was sort of like one or two a year, and that's gone, I think, up to now 15, and it's predicted to rise to nearly 100. So really, the situation that you're converging to is that the gates will be up all the time. So you have the nutrients, some fresh water still coming in, and you're basically changing an estuary which was breathing, venting through the mouth into the Adriatic. It'll be closed off. The other thing is the property values in Venice are going up at such a rate that really very few people live there now. And the old Venetian families have pretty much all moved out because, you know, it's not exactly a comfortable place to live. If the rents are high, the property values are high, your foundations are eroding, so the maintenance costs are extremely high. So really what you've got is sort of like a Disneyland or a museum with a tremendous amount of cultural heritage, lots of tourists, but really very few people living there. So I think the world, it's not an Italian problem so much, it's more a world problem. Do we want to keep this beautiful city, what used to be beautiful, it's pretty dilapidated now, and rejuvenate it for the sake that we can see it, but it'll be in a totally artificial context.
One country that has had literally a lifetime of living with water is the Netherlands. About half of its surface area is less than 1 meter above sea level, and large parts of it are actually below sea level. Increasingly sophisticated use of dikes and pumps, including windmills which were used from the Middle Ages until the 19th century, has allowed the people living there to reclaim land and largely protect it from the sea. Storms and floods in the 12th century led to the creation of small regional authorities responsible for maintaining safe water levels, thus creating the building blocks of the modern Dutch state, according to Ruth Oldenziel, Professor of American and European History of Technology at the Technical University Eindhoven.
Actually, the Netherlands, from its very early beginnings that we know anything about any kind of village or city development from the 12th century, has always been part of managing the water, fighting against or managing it. So actually, it's deeply ingrained in Dutch culture. And over the century, it has developed into what some scholars believe to be a rather unique water culture, if you will, by which local and regional water boards run by local landowners and farmers have negotiated together to share a sense of, you know, a common enemy or sharing a kind of project to make sure that the water would not flood communities. And this kind of water culture, some people believe, are actually the foundations of a Dutch Republic and its democratic culture, this sense of working together.
This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National with me, Keri Phillips. Today we're exploring a brief history of human settlement and water, looking at drowned cities as a context for considering the two big water-related disasters of recent times, the tsunami of 2004 and Hurricane Katrina, and what might lie ahead. The Netherlands, not surprisingly, has a history of catastrophic floods. There are records of big storms in the Middle Ages, including one in 1287 when 50,000 people died. The most significant event in modern times occurred in 1953, when the dikes protecting the southwest of the country were breached by hurricane-force winds and exceptionally high spring tides. The flood came at night without warning, and almost 2,000 people died. Curiously, following this disaster, Dutch delegates visited Louisiana to inspect the levees along the Mississippi River built in the 1920s and 30s. The Dutch Delta Project, a vast construction effort designed to end the threat from the sea once and for all, was carried out over the next 40 years. It consists essentially of a series of dams and storm surge barriers, vast movable gates, some as big as a 12-story block of flats. Its goal was to withstand extreme flood conditions that might occur once every 10,000 years.
The essence of the Delta Project was that it was going to protect the country against any possible storm or calamity. It had a very long-term vision. So it really, I mean, it comes out of its idea of the 50s, that man can shape with the engineering work, can shape society and its environment. A bit arrogant, one might say. And before that, people had always had a calculated risk about living with the water. But since then, the idea was to ensure that the Netherlands would be, as I said, metaphorically, for any calamity in 1 million years. The Delta works involves basically the whole southwestern country. It's a system of dikes on the one hand and dams on the other hand. It has cut off pieces of rivers. It has reconstructed land. It has created wetlands. And it is a national engineering of the land, as it has always been. But this is on a much grander scale. What the Delta Plan entailed was really closing off parts of the Rhine and the Meuse rivers, and also building gigantic dams, which in the one hand, which was also part of a struggle in the 70s, to make a dam that was also kept intact the wetlands. The 1953 Delta Plan was really an engineering philosophy of water control, of keeping water out. Since then, the plan has evolved in keeping the water out, but also having the water interplay with the land. And so it actually has evolved over time and has become one in which water is also welcomed in a way in wetlands. And if we compare that to Katrina, there the wetlands have been cut off, and water engineers now understand that that can have also a disastrous impact on the water system. A man cannot control water under all circumstances. You have to give it room and have it take the land as well. In the Netherlands, because it is a national plan, there are strict rules of where or where one cannot build. However, the Netherlands is also the most densely populated country in Europe. There are about 470 people per square kilometer. And so land use is, of course, also very much in contested terrain. And since the Delta Plan, there is now a development to see how you can build houses that actually float more or less underwater and can also deal with disasters of the kind of 1953 or that of the scale of Katrina. But that is a development of, let's say, the last 10, 15 years. The idea that with global warming, one not only can keep water out, but one has to live with water.
Although the Delta Project is considered by the American Society of Civil Engineers one of the seven wonders of the modern world, and the Dutch are still in the vanguard of this area of engineering, Jorg Imberger says that the 20th century was not necessarily a time of great innovation.
The advances are nothing dramatic. I mean, basically a retaining wall is just the retaining wall, and how to build one was known hundreds of years ago. What's happened now is that we can build one a little more cheaply because we have better technology, we understand the forces on it better. The second advance has been that we have a better understanding of the likely change, but that comment is really a bit dated now because we, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, we began to have a pretty good understanding of the statistical variation of the climate and water level change and so forth. And all these retaining walls are all built on some statistical likely large storm. And your listeners should realize that it's a couple of things. It's sea level change. It's the wind piling up the water. If the wind blows towards the shore, it piles up the water. And thirdly is that if there's a high tide, in other words, the moon and the sun assist in that as well. I think scientists generally knew how to predict those things. But now with climate variability or climate change taking this sudden deviation, we now no longer know how to do that. So building the wall carries no problem. It's a matter of willpower and money and legislative processes. The problem is, you know, how big do we now, for instance, in Venice, how tall Are we going to plan for a 7-meter rise in sea level, or are we going to plan for a 30-centimeter sea level rise? When they rebuild the walls in Louisiana and or New Orleans and so forth, they're just putting back what was there before. The same walls, the same city, the same streets, the same everything, which of course is a really missed opportunity. If you go to Holland now, Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, a lot of those places, they're actually beginning to take down these structures, and they're also beginning to take out the concrete channels in the rivers, which were also designed to allow the flood to quickly dissipate down into the ocean and minimize the flooding, and reverting back to natural systems. And in order to do that, they have to basically move people out of the flood areas and so forth, because they realize that we need, as a society, or perhaps as a human race, we need a buffer zone there for two reasons. One is a buffer zone because we don't know the uncertainties. And secondly, we need a buffer zone to maintain some biodiversity. It's pretty similar in Australia. I mean, the roads at the moment are being built right next to the beach, and all the sand dunes are actually being developed for housing and so forth. The way Europe is now going is that they would not allow this anymore. In fact, they would remove a lot of their roads and houses and allow, say, half a kilometer or something like that of sand dunes, which would act as a buffer zone to any potential large storm.
In New Orleans, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is hurrying to ready the city for the start of another hurricane season in June. Instead of inspiring a large-scale, long-term project like the Dutch Delta Plan, Hurricane Katrina has simply won a promise from Congress to look at a report the Army engineers will prepare, giving costings of protection against another Category 5 hurricane. Greg Breerwood, Deputy District Engineer for Project Management in the New Orleans District, was part of a recent delegation that went from Louisiana to the Netherlands.
60% of Holland is below sea level. 70% of that gross national product is received from that 60%. So from a national perspective, their whole economy depends on protecting themselves from sea. In the case of New Orleans and some of the Gulf Coast and the United States, it is just that area that is at risk. And so the rest of the country, the United States, has to look at not only that risk and how much that would cost to protect, as opposed to all of the other needs in the United States. And they will look at that from that perspective, from the national perspective, and determine exactly what it is that's going to take to protect the city of New Orleans and that area.
And as New Orleans celebrated Mardi Gras last week, almost exactly 6 months after the storm hit, thousands of residents have applied for permission to rebuild their homes in the same place at the same elevation.
If climate change kicks in, and I mean the general predictions are anywhere from half a meter. Some people are actually saying if all the ice fields melt in Greenland and Iceland and so forth, then the sea level is going to be more like 7 meters. Well, I mean, even half a meter will basically eliminate, I would just guess, at about 70% of all the beaches in Australia. So, you will simply no longer be able to go down the beach and have a swim. You'll have to negotiate a wall that's keeping the ocean at bay, because we've built so close to the beach, the houses and the roads and so forth. So the only way to stabilize that will be putting retaining walls. And so the whole character of Australia will change. But as you probably also know, very few people are actually interested in this problem. If you look at the Department of Planning and Infrastructure in Western Australia, the bylaw is still written that you shall not build within 6 inches of water level rise. So the legislation is still in inches. So that's how far behind we are, really. And I think that's quite typical around Australia generally.
Professor Jörg Imberger, the director of the Centre for Water Research at the University of Western Australia. Don't forget to check out the Rear Vision website at abc.net.au/rn. There are transcripts and audio there, and you can also email us and post a comment in our guest book. The technical producer today is Angus Kingston. I'm Keri Phillips. Bye for now. Wash us away.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.